Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Jordy Bailey. I'm trying to do my Geralt voice.
And I'm the bard always singing his praises, Duncan Nicol.
Duncan, it's been a long time coming for me reading these books. I've been thinking about reading The Witcher for some time. I actually got given The Blood of Elves during the pandemic as like a birthday present. And I very gently told the person who gave it to me, this isn't actually the first book. And she said, it says it's the first novel right there on the back. And I explained, yes, it is the first novel, but it's not where you're supposed to start. So I'm going to put this on the shelf and then lose it because I have no idea where that book is.
Oh, that is very unfortunate, but to be honest, a very fair thing to do. So today we are reviewing the collection of short stories published as a volume, The Last Wish, which is actually the title of one of the short stories in the collection. This is very much the place you should start when reading the Witcher series. And I get why people get it wrong. The Witcher series is a little bit confusing. As of recording, there are 8 books in the series. And I am saying as of recording, because there are so many rumours dashing about. And as a quick breakdown, the first 2 volumes in the series, The Last Wish and The Sword of Destiny, they are both short story collections. The Witcher started out as short stories being written separately and evolved further down the line. The Blood of Elves is the first full-length novel and kicks off a 5-novel-long arc, which is very much the main Witcher storyline. There is then finally an 8th novel, which, as I understand, is a prequel, which sort of fills in some of the more background mechanisms happening during the time frame of these short stories. But if you want a starting place, there is no debate. It is The Last Wish. Oh, and for those fans of the video games, because loads of people probably come to The Witcher through the video games, they are all set after all the novels have taken place, and you don't need to read the novels to play the games, and the games do a pretty decent job both being set after the novels but not spoiling the novels. I think, well done.
And Duncan, you know, like, I understand that, like, the chronology of how to read these books can get a little confusing at times for some people, especially when you factor in video games. Would you say that the TV show is a nice handy-dandy shortcut for people who want to get into the books nice and quickly?
So if we're talking about the Netflix TV show, because there was an original Polish production in the early 2000s, but yes, the Netflix TV show. Yeah, there was. I think it even got translated as, like, The Hexer, because they didn't think anyone knew what a Witcher was, because obviously we didn't. The Netflix TV show starring Henry Cavill, the first season is a pretty darn good season of television, which cherry picks some of the short stories in the first 2 volumes. And yeah, if you did watch that TV show, it would kind of take you up to Blood of Elves fairly nicely. Obviously, I don't recommend that. These are 2 really good volumes, as we'll get into later, and I rate them very highly. But that is a very good one-to-one introduction to this world. Sadly, the Netflix TV show does go off on its own piece after that, and it gets weird. It season 2, they basically just go, we're not going to adapt it anymore. Sod that noise, let's tell our own story. And then season 3, even weirders go, actually no, retcon, let's get back on track. It's messy, but season 1...
And apparently that's why Henry Cavill quit the show. He's like, you're disrespecting Sapkowski's source material, I'm fed up and I'm walking. And the next season, which is yet to come out, is going to star a completely different man as the main actor of the TV show.
I know, and they can't even Doctor Who it. You know, there's no in-universe
way what I was gonna say.
To explain this. It's just going to be a different actor. And I'll be honest, like, I don't want to say I'm not, you know, I don't think this would be good, because it could be. It might surprise me. But I have never been so concerned. There's been a slew of, like, new big fantasy TV shows after Game of Thrones, hasn't there? You know, everyone wants to be the next Game of Thrones. Mm. And what's really interesting is that while some of the Amazon TV shows, like Wheel of Time and The Lord of the Rings show, they started off worse than The Witcher. Like, I was so ready to be like, yeah, no, The Witcher season 1, this is the best. They're, you know, it's a different vibe, but they've really nailed it. And what I find fascinating is that The Witcher, despite starting out the highest, has nothing but trend down as a TV show, while The Rings of Power and The Wheel of Time, starting out in definitely much worse locations, I will at least admit, I think they have trended up over the course of their 2 seasons. So who knows where things will end up.
I don't know what to tell you. I only watched the first season of The Witcher, said, that was pretty good. people were like, second season's not as good. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to watch that. I started watching the first two episodes of the second season of The Rings of Power. I was like, okay, this is crap. And I stopped.
Well, I would actually kind of recommend The Wheel of Time. I think it's doing decently at the moment. So there's that. But Geordie, enough about the TV shows. Before we actually get into talking about the stories, have you been reading anything else you want to share?
Not really. I've been very busy. You know, Duncan, we forgot to say this. Duncan, you're recording in a different room than usual, so the acoustics might be a little bit different. And I'm going to be moving house soon. By the end of next month, I'll be in a different location, so I'll be having my own teething issues then. But stuff like that has been keeping me much too busy. It's been a very busy time at work. I don't have time to read, write, or do anything. So I managed to finish The Witcher just in time. But, yeah.
No, fair enough. And I do hope my new acoustics are working out. It was quite the elaborate setup to get this going for today. And I've been in the same place as you, Geordie. Very busy time. I've not had time to read any other novels. But I have had a fair bit of time to read some comic books. And I recently, after Christmas, lovely present I got from my mother was a subscription to Kindle Unlimited, which I'm determined, obviously, to get as much value out of it as I can. And it just so happens that the entirety of the Red Sonja comic book series is available on Kindle Unlimited.
Right, so that's the Gail Simone one where she's defending Hyrcania, right?
That is one of them. So Red Sonja is a sword and sorcery character.
Is it the one where she's in the modern day fighting wizards?
That's the Amy Chu run. I'll just give a very brief overview because I do think they're really quite fun. And worth giving a go. Red Sonja's a sword and sorcery character, based off some Robert E. Howard character, but kind of created by Roy Thomas in the late 1970s, another Marvel comic book. Anyway, it's been with Dynamite for the last sort of 20 years, the comic books. And what they do, interesting enough, is every time a new kind of creative team comes in, they fully throw their hands in the air and bring them down on like the reboot button. So it's fully accepted, and they even try to square it off two times, one as reincarnation, and now they've gone full just multiverse, that these are completely different iterations. So you'll literally get, Gail Simone did an excellent run of about 18 issues. That's slightly contentious in the fandom, but I say it's excellent. But then when you read, like, say, the Amy Chu run, they'll have a different backstory, like a different origin, vaguely the same. Some of the characters have got similar names, but it's definitively a separate version of the character. I've just finished reading the Mark Russell run, which is effectively known as Volume 5, which I just want to say, it was really good. If you're interested in the character, definitely start with the Gail Simone run mentioned earlier, but the Mark Russell run is an excellent one to move on to. It's definitely my second favourite run, maybe my pushing up to be my first. It takes the character of Red Sonja, who's this incredible sword and sorcery hero, no one can beat her in a one-to-one combat, and then asks the question, okay, she can beat anyone in a sword fight. But what does she do when she's facing down an invading army? How can this single soldier... compare it to Berserk, which might not be 100% fair. But it's that same question of, okay, great, you can defend yourself. You're untouchable. But you've got a whole nation you're trying to keep safe. You've got family. You've got civilians. How do you spread yourself about? What sacrifices do you make? And how do you come to terms with the fact that sometimes it doesn't matter how good an individual you are, you can't be everywhere at once. You know, you can't fight every battle.
I have read the beginning of that run, and that stuff really is the most interesting part. It carried me through a lot more of the series than I was expecting, because it was just like, yeah, wow, this is really compelling stuff, and it really, like, sparks your imagination. And Gail Simone has now written a Red Sonja novel as well, right?
Yes, Red Sonja Consumed. It's the first Red Sonja novel, gosh, for 35 years. If not longer. And I'm really excited to see the character kind of extend out into prose. I would like to see what Gail Simone does. Gail Simone's Red Sonja was always a little bit more traditional sword and sorcery, low stakes, focusing on the fight that Red Sonja is in. And I really like that version. So we will see where she goes. There's meant to be a film coming out. There was meant to be a film last year.
Oh yeah, that's
and
right.
It's got delayed. And then gone quiet, and
that's always a good sign.
It was in development hell for like 15 years, and then they were like, they're making it, and everyone was like, oh, this is amazing. And then they're like, we finished it, just go do the special effects, and we're like, oh, that's even more amazing. And then people were like, right, we just got to find someone who wants to, you know, distribute it, and that's actually proving really hard. And you're going, That's alarming.
Yes, that's a bad sign.
But he's hoping, and I've been actually thinking of doing Red Sonja on the podcast since we started, Geordie. And I've honestly just been going, well, it'd be really good to do it maybe around when the film comes out. You know, good bit of synergy there. And I'm still waiting.
That's funny. I like it. All right, let's crack on. Speaking of sword and sorcery, Duncan, and speaking of, like, feisty ladies, The Witcher.
Yes, The Witcher.
It's really interesting. I think that it's kind of fascinating that quite a popular and successful fantasy series like The Witcher, it's pretty much unheard of for a book series to get turned into video games. That does not happen.
Certainly not to jump
that it begins
the film iteration in between.
Yeah, like I remember playing Eragon on PS2. After the film came out, but it was an adaptation of the film. It wasn't an adaptation of the book.
Genuinely,
because otherwise it would have been a good video game.
Only other ones I can think of is... Sorry, actually, I'm slightly going to not rain on your parade, but I'm thinking, actually, no, Lord of the Rings had a few games that came out ahead of the films. And there was like...
More like The Hobbit.
Yeah, there was a Hobbit game on the PS2, but even going back in time, there was like...
Yeah, I remember that.
There was Lord of the Rings games... on the Super Nintendo. They were like old PC text adventure games. Oh yeah. There's a little bit of history of Lord of the Rings. Not loads. And this, we're talking about The Lord of the Rings, the best selling fantasy series of all time. Actually, I don't know where it compares to Harry Potter, but anyway. So
yeah, it's definitely not.
Whereas The Witcher, despite being definitely having a lot of gravitas and its fans being very dedicated to it, I'm not sure how big of a international fan base it had. And I'm not sure quite how...
Well, the video games were made by a Polish studio. So they probably were just like... They were like local fans of the books. They were like, yeah, this is sort of an unknown gem. Because like, I remember reading that like book sales of this book, of this series, kind of exploded after The Witcher 3. Like, that was like 10 years ago or something. And this book came out in 1993. So there's like a 20-year period of like relative obscurity, a pretty popular book in its home country, it has some access abroad, and then explodes because the adaptation did so well. I've heard that Sapkowski, the author, is actually kind of bitter about, you know, people's perception of his work being coloured so much by a game studio.
I can certainly see where he might be coming from. Obviously, I always have to just say, well, I wouldn't know what The Witcher is if it wasn't for the game, and I don't think we'd have had a Netflix series if it wasn't from the game. So I'm sorry that it's overshadowing your original ideas, because clearly you're the originator and you deserve the credit for. I hope the money you've made makes up for that.
Duncan.
Yes.
What is The Witcher?
The Witcher. So, Geralt of Rivia is a Witcher, one of many in this world. Or some in this world. And effectively, it is a human who has been magically mutated a little bit to essentially be superhuman. And they go around hunting monsters for gold.
I mean, yes, it really came out in a nice sweet spot in the early 90s because the dark, edgy version of fairy tales, like, that's something we saw happening repeatedly through the, like, late 90s through to the early 2000s. And thinking of, you know, your Van Helsings, your Hansel and Gretel vampire hunter, your Fable. This is something that was going to kind of burst into the oeuvre, edgifying fairy tales. I'm sure it had been done before as well. But having this gruff, strong, wish-fulfillment male protagonist come in there as this like sword swinging badass entering into familiar settings of, you know, fairy tales. We see references to Cinderella, to the Beauty and the Beast, very familiar fairy tale properties, and then making it for the boys, you know?
That's certainly one way to look at it. It's interesting because I don't think in the wider scope of like the zeitgeist that The Witcher has built around it, the fact that it started out very much from a dark sword and sorcery take on fairy tales is that much at the forefront. But revisiting this collection, pretty much every single story in here is at least one fairy tale or has elements of one fairy tale in it.
It genuinely surprised me because I didn't realize. I knew that. Like, okay, I've played The Witcher 3. No, hang on. I've played the first fifth of The Witcher 3.
Oh, so only about 200 hours.
Yes. Okay. I played the first tenth then of The Witcher 3. And I knew that it had, like, a folkloric origin. I knew that, like, kind of the big appeal that the game had is that it does present a slightly unfamiliar skew on folklore and fairy tales because it has this Eastern European perspective instead of, like, a Western European perspective that I'm quite familiar with. So I'm very familiar with, like, French and Germanic versions of fairy tales. And now, like, we've got these different words for monsters showing up, and it lends it this layer of foreignness, of slight dark exoticism. You know, I don't know what a Strigger is, for example. You know, I figured out later, but it's like it's a different version of the vampire myth that it created Dracula in the Strigoi. But hey, it's familiar. It's strange. It's a new take. I didn't realize how absolutely tied into just pretty typical grim fairy tale stuff it was.
I know you really hit on a key point there of the fact that, you know, this is unknown to us, particularly obviously, you know, we're both English and probably most of the Western European influences is what you see in America as well, or their popular culture. So I'm kind of this fascinated, like, what relationship do people maybe who are already familiar with this, how well known are these myths in their home country? I'd love to know what that kind of playoff is. There's certainly an element as well that we're highlighting, so the cultural differences is the language differences. Something that I had coming into this was the fact that I had been told by a work colleague who was from Poland. He's like, oh, the books are amazing. Oh, but the English translations. I was like, what's wrong with the English translations? It's like, you miss so much. I was like, well, I can't, I'm not able to learn another language. So I mean, he did throw me a bone. He did say, well, actually, the German version's really good. And I was like, thanks. Can't speak German either, but good to
you
know.
You speak a Germanic language. That's close, right?
Well, there are certainly little elements and quibbles and differences between the translation in this book and what the Netflix series goes for, which can be quite interesting to pick up on.
Well, go on. Speak to that, then.
Well, the main one that sticks out, there's a few little ones when it comes to place names. The biggest one I think most people will be familiar with is the character of Dandelion.
Yes, of course, right.
So in the Netflix series, I believe they go with Jaskier, his name, which is just the Polish name.
Polish word for dandelion.
I actually had someone once tell me that it's actually a different flower, but they've done a literal translation of a name, and you're like, and I think they do that for a few places as well, where a place will have a very direct name. This is not an actual example, but just because it's popped in my head, you know, it's somewhere was called like Castle Black.
Yeah.
In some examples, they've translated it literally, whereas I do believe in the Netflix series, they've left it with the actual Polish name.
Interesting.
I think it's much of a muchness personally. I don't think it impacts anything in this book. Did I go, oh gosh, I wish they hadn't? But then again, I'm coming from the perspective of not being able to experience the other translation. I would say that for an English reader, if you're someone who have heard these things and have been a bit wary that it's putting you off, you think you're getting an inferior product, I'm just going to say, don't worry.
Yeah, it's not like there's anything you can do about that unless you want to learn Polish, and good for you. I mean, not good for you. It's a very hard language to learn. I was speaking to a Polish friend of mine and he said, and he was explaining that, like, essentially, you know how in, like, Eastern Europe, a lot of them use Cyrillic languages? Polish basically should use a Cyrillic language, but chooses not to. So they invent new letters that no one else uses. So my favorite thing he ever told me was, I asked him, hey, should I say his name? Hey, pal, this L with a diagonal line through it, what sound does that make? I saw it on a map of Poland, and he said, oh, that's a V sound. And I went, what? It can't be a V sound. What are you talking about?
Oh, I feel like I'm on thin ice. I don't want to comment on that.
It's just good fun.
Yes, it does. It's a unique one. It's certainly, again, if you're interested in the culture, fantastic. Hell, at least I've been told that the German version is the next best and probably a little bit more widely spoken. But don't worry, the English version, thumbs up. So let's get into these actual stories. The Last Wish has 7 short stories within it, and there is a kind of framing narrative that we cut back to throughout.
Duncan, should we just, like, super duper quickly go through each story and literally just say good, bad, or whatever, you know?
Okay. Yes. So let's go for it.
The first story is The Witcher. That's the one where he, wait, which one is that? That's the one where he fights the Strigger, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thumbs up. I like this one.
Thumbs up as well. This is a brilliantly compact, like, standalone. This is everything you're expecting to get in one story. Perfect.
Very
opening.
Good sword and sorcery stuff. It lays out a lot of lore, but it does it with, like, characters talking back and forth in an engaging way. And then there's a pretty cool fight scene at the end. The next one is The Grain of A Grain of Truth. Beauty and the Beast, but for the boys. If you didn't like A Court of Thorns and Roses, this one is for you.
This one has a very good twist, I think, at the end. Although I do think just going through the story, it was a bit slower. I didn't have the same kind of sense of tension that I did in the previous one. But the ending definitely made up for it.
Definitely.
I still give it a thumbs up.
I give this one actually quite a strong thumbs up. I enjoyed the format a lot, where it is a, like, you know, it's a retelling of Beauty and the Beast from a different perspective. Because as weird as, you know, the commonality of, like, feminist retellings of various fairy tales along with myths is, and, you know, we've done A Court of Thorns and Roses, which is an adaptation of Beauty and the Beast and Eros and Psyche, you actually don't, in my experience, get that many versions of a story that are from the Beast's perspective. And in this case, not only was it a version that's from the Beast's perspective instead of Beauty, but it was actually just, like, a big twist on it, in that the very framing of the curse itself was, well, it was just extremely different from anything we've seen before. Maybe get into it later, and you're right, I liked the twist at the end as well.
Next one up, The Lesser Evil. Interesting enough, this was the one that the Netflix series chose to adapt in its opening.
And I can see why. I think that it's a smart choice to start with this one, because I think it really puts... This is kind of what The Witcher is all about. It's all about big moral conflicts. The division between what is a man and what is a monster. I can see why you'd start with this. But having watched the first season of The Witcher, it then meant that the episode which adapts The Witcher feels really redundant. It's no longer an introduction to Geralt. It's just an extraneous episode about him fighting a monster. And if I stretch my brain back a lot, it also introduces... What's that character's name? Triss? Trim?
Oh, now you've made me get confused. Triss Merryweather?
Merrygold.
Merrygold, thank you.
Yeah, but she just, like, walks in, talks in for a bit, and then leaves. So that was a weird episode. This story, on its own, I think pretty good. Slower than I remember the show being, but it has a... It's the source of a story where, like, the misogyny kind of rears its head the highest.
It certainly does. I think what this story does very well is that it frames a moral quandary to Geralt very much front and centre, and it establishes for the character what his initial worldview is crystal clear. And this is, I find, really interesting. I think, in many respects, this is one of the most important stories in this collection. Anyway, because it kind of establishes the worldview of Geralt that then gets challenged throughout the rest of the series.
And that being the idea of there being no lesser evil.
Yes, I think, I don't know if this is actually, do you know what, I'm having a horrible moment now, Geordie, where there's a quote, I'm like, this is definitely from the book, I'm not just confusing it for the TV show.
I know exactly when you're
where Geralt goes.
Yeah.
It's lesser evil, lesser, greater, middling, evil is evil.
Yes. Is this in the book? I want you to recite it for me, because I told you ahead of this episode, I think we should both try and do Geralt impressions, because he's, I think the voice is best known from the video games, because the voice actor in that is extremely good. but I'd like to hear your best attempt at it. I don't think mine's very good.
Okay, what, in like a Geralt voice? In like a grizzled kind of... No, I can't do that.
Duncan, by the way, it's the end of chapter 2 of that one. So if you want to go through your version of the book...
Oh, I will tell you now, Jordan, you just have to type in Geralt evil quote and Google lets you know.
Okay, fair enough.
Evil is evil, Shrugabor. Lesser, greater, middling, it's all the same. Proportions are negotiated. Boundaries are blurred. I'm not a pious hermit. I haven't done only good in my life. But if I'm to choose between one evil and another, then I prefer not to choose at all.
You know, when I said that, Duncan, I kind of did imply that you should try and do the very gruff, you know, badass fantasy voice.
Well, I can't do that. What's a gruff? Gruff.
I'm gonna...
No. You step in.
Duncan, I want to quote now from from the direct chat we did. I quote, Duncan, and my Geralt impression is impeccable. So that was a lie.
Oh, a massive lie.
I'm going to give it my best go. Hang on. Wind's howling. Wind's howling. Yennefer. Yennefer. Evil is evil, Stregobor. Lesser, greater, middling, it's all the same. Proportions negotiated, boundaries blurred. I'm not a pious hermit. I haven't done only good in my life. But if I'm to choose between one evil and another, then I prefer not to choose at all.
I think Henry Cavill probably did it better. But you know who did even better than that? So, Duncan, the audience will hear this before you do, but... I know someone who does a surprisingly good Geralt impression, and that is my girlfriend, Lauren. And I had her come round the house yesterday and record her version of her impression, and it's much better than mine.
Much better than mine?
Duncan, it's a little bit better than yours, just a little. And now, the audience will be lucky enough to hear that.
Wow, that was impressive, I say, not having heard it.
You can hear it later on, everyone else.
Moving on then from the lesser evil.
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. Not as good as the others.
We get a story which I would say has the most links in terms of setting up the greater narrative, and that is A Question of Price.
Yeah.
A Question of Price.
This is an interesting one.
I'm actually fairly middling. Like, this is the one where I think my thumb is twitching most to that kind of just horizontal position.
I hear what you're saying, man. I'm kind of in the same camp. It's interesting how different it is. It really feels like Sapkowski was like, I'm going to try and show Geralt in a very different situation where he isn't fighting for his life. You know, it doesn't culminate in... There is a kerfuffle, but it's not a huge, important sword fight. And this one gets down to...
The word kerfuffle is amazing. is that how you show it? The interaction with the Striker, you're like, oh, Geralt had a bit of a kerfuffle with the Striker.
No, but that
in the
was a proper fight. This is a kerfuffle. This is just I'm like, come here.
Pushing and shoving.
Yes.
Less stabbing.
It includes some important things in the series. One, it shows that Sapkowski knows what a billhook is. That's nice. We never see those in fantasy novels. But two... it adds the theme of destiny. You know, I guess the previous story did that as well a little bit, but this one, it feels more like an actual tangible force in the universe, like gravity.
Indeed. So part of this story, and I don't know, I don't think this is exactly pulling from a specific fairy tale that I know of.
I don't know either. I think it's more in the spirit of fairy tales, because it's about rules, and that's what this story is really about and what it does the most effectively.
This story introduces the concept of the law of surprise, and effectively we're dealing with a cursed prince who saved a king's life and asked him for, when the king offered him a boon for his service, he said, I invoke the law of surprise, which means that when the king returns home, whatever he's surprised by when he gets home is belonging to this chap. And on this particular occasion, he comes home to be surprised that his wife is pregnant.
Not merely pregnant, I think she's giving birth.
Oh my, even a bigger surprise. He must have been away for quite some time.
So you've heard Duncan and I do our best to do Geralt impressions, from, and I think mine's not very good.
Pages and pages of the Witcher.
I do know someone who has
an
almost alarmingly good
Geralt impression.
It looks like it probably is just for the books, you know.
That's because you know what I usually sound like.
That sort of premise, that idea that an oath has been made,
not deep, gruff, monster hunter choice.
You only do that on like the weekends.
And just for fun, it's a good party trick.
It's also
sort of just the one quote
that I can
do.
It kind of comes down to a sort of weird negotiation.
This is my girlfriend, Lauren.
Hello.
And there's all stuff in it.
I think
just really
heard
just
at one point in the background
fun.
Of one episode.
And frankly, this is probably the greatest disparity between the TV show and the
Saoirse.
Book comes in.
Yeah.
Because I remember really enjoying this episode of the TV show.
Yes. So effectively, what happens is this cursed prince who looks like a concubine. No.
Porcupine. Evil struck a ball.
That's the word. Concubine. So different.
Lesser.
Yep. Shows up to claim the princess's hand.
Now,
the queen, the king's partner at this point, is not having this. And is like, Geralt, can you please deal with the problem? And Geralt goes,
That's it. That's all I've got.
He doesn't seem like a bit of a monstrous threat. So I'm going to go on this one and sit it out. And this is where we get, like, there's a bit of pushing and shoving. Other people are like, I'll fight, I won't. And Geralt does a lot of just sitting back and observing. The end of this story is that the princess and the cursed prince are to be together, and they turn to Geralt and say, Geralt...
Because she wants to. That's the important
thing. Yes. He's her chosen.
And the TV show, this is great, because she's a grown woman, and it turns out she's always been in love with this knight from afar. In the book, she's 14 years old, and he's like in his late 30s, and he's been grooming her his whole life. Her whole life.
Yep. This is where the fact that this guy was always there's an age gap built into this, because obviously he had to be old enough to do the thing with the king before she's even born. And again, the TV show, they just kind of play it off with smudging the dates and having the actors being of an acceptable age. The book puts it right in center. And you're right, Geordie,
this is part of that early 90s, you know, similar to A Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire, where it's like, we're taking the fact that it's medieval fantasy seriously. We're going to have the same cultural norms as would exist back then. So this girl is coming of age at 14, and she's going to be sent off to be married to all these potential suitors at a very young age. All the men are much older than her. The book is not, like, praising this, it's just saying, you know, this is how it is. But still, like, I think there's definitely ways to fudge this. Like, for example, if the king had been off at war for a long time, like Odysseus, and he had come back and he had discovered that his daughter was like 7 years old, but he'd never discovered that you know, that the child had been born because he'd been so far away. And then the knight who rescued him was like 15 years old, very young. Way more tolerable, right?
It's kind of the thing of like, how far do you want to go out your way for this? Now, I don't know how to say. It makes me a little bit unhappy as a reader.
He could have been a boy. Like, he could have been a little boy who helped
the king. Absolutely. Do you know what, actually, Geordie? That probably would be my preferred. Like, you could have had this be like an 8-year-old who slings like a rock. And that's why, because also, if you're a full-blown adult, you might just go, yeah, can I have a farm and a sackload of gold, please? But being some idealistic child of fantasy and wonder, he invokes the law of surprise. It was a creative choice.
Absolutely. And also, it's set up, like, in this book, like, he deliberately chose for law of surprise because he knew how powerful the oath was, and that would be powerful enough to overcome, you know, the curse that's upon him that's turned him into a hedgehog. Anyway, the last big change that happens in this is at the end of the book, Geralt, it's revealed by another character that Geralt is also the product of the Law of Surprise. That's how he became a Witcher. And in fact, I think this is the story we learn about, like, the Trial of the Grasses, right? We get a little bit more lore on what makes someone a Witcher. And that Geralt's special because he was really good at accepting the trials, and that's why he's like an albino. Because he got extra special experiments used on him.
But there is this other difference, and that is Geralt at the end of this story also gets offered a boon of his choice, and he invokes the Law of Surprise again. And what's interesting is, in the book, Geralt does this very much in the knowledge or with the intention that this will result in a child being linked to him.
Yes, this is probably the biggest change in the entire book compared to the adaptation.
In the adaptation, there's a almost play for laugh scene where Geralt almost does the Law of Surprise nonchalantly as like a joke. And then when the queen immediately turns around and vomits and they go, oh my goodness, you're pregnant. He literally stands there and is like, fuck, I did not intend that.
I mean, he does love to say the word fuck in the TV show, so that's true.
And that's like, oh gosh, you know, what a shock, what a surprise. Whereas in this one, it's like, no, I want this child of destiny to be linked to me. And I've never been quite clear on this. It's because he wants there to be more witches. Like, he wants this child to have to walk this path with him.
And this isn't the same story where he says, like, 1 in 5 children survive the trial. So he has ensured the birth of this child and now is like, and I'm going to roll the dice on this. And explicitly, he doesn't believe in destiny. So he's not even saying, like, well, it's a sure thing that a child will survive the trials because its destiny is bound to me. Because that doesn't fly with his character at all. So it's very bizarre.
And that's interesting because Geralt doesn't believe in destiny, yet he still takes the Law of Surprise very seriously. And his whole plan is that everyone else takes it as seriously as he does. It made me feel kind of, I think it's less about that inconsistency, it just made me feel uncomfortable on Geralt. Like, this looks quite bad on him to basically be like, what do you want? I want to force this child through my life. And Geralt is very honest, I feel, that his life is not necessarily a great one.
I know, it just feels really out of line with the character.
And it's something that comes up further down the line where Geralt does get quite protective of the child ultimately is Ciri, who, if you watch TV show, play the games, we all know. And some of his actions later down the line almost seem slightly remorseful or pushing her away from the dangerous lifestyle of being a Witcher. And I'm like, then when did you... His thought process I am yet to see really play out. Like, when did you change your mind? Why did you do this? Obviously, external factors come into play. And ultimately, this decision does save Ciri's life on sort of the large scale. But Geralt didn't know that at the time.
Yeah, so strange ending. I definitely preferred the TV show version of it. It sort of makes sense. Especially the idea that, like, saying something the wrong way, like literally cracking a joke, basically, leads to this, like, this accident of destiny. I think it's way more appropriate for a fairy tale thing, where, like, saying a wish wrong is really important, or being careful with your words with the fairies is important. So I felt like that adaptation made some really smart choices.
Moving on. Next one. The Edge of the World.
Oh, this one's crap.
I'm quite disappointed by this story too. Now, this story introduces some really great elements. It introduces the elves, and it introduces, they're sort of alluded to earlier on, but this really introduces the plight of this, of the race of the elves in the world of The Witcher. And it's the idea that they once were on top, they once were the mightiest beings, but humanity has fully toppled them, and they're being pushed and pushed to the edges of society. And they are feared and they are hated, and in many respects, because of that, they are being forced into militarizing and very much becoming more so the threat that people think of them.
Yep, there's some neat ideas here.
Yes, sorry, actually let's expand on this before we hit the next main fact of the story. This is a cool idea, and it's very much a subset of the world building in The Witcher. Now, I haven't finished the main series, I'm only up to the time of Contempt, so I don't know how much this plays into the wider narrative, the elves' sort of role. So far, though, it's very much a subplot. It's something that's going on in the background, it's affecting the mechanisms of the kingdoms and the politics, but it hasn't really hit our main characters yet. So, I'll be interesting to know where this eventually goes.
As this story to me was just sort of like a huge emphasis on lore. You know, it wants to introduce the elves as characters. It wants to make this big statement about the history of the world. And it does it to such an extent that it does it to the detriment of the characters having agency. You know, it's not strictly speaking the first story where Dandelion appears, because he's already shown up in the framing narrative, which we haven't spoken about yet, and I'm sure we'll talk about it last. However, this is the first story where he appears as an actual character, and in the TV show, I think they even make this into the first meeting of Dandelion and Geralt, which is not the case in the story. At least in the TV show, this acted as a sort of framing device of like, this is how Geralt and, in that case, Jaskier, or in this case, Dandelion, meet. So for that reason, that episode has a purpose. You know, it's establishing a relationship. In this case, when they just sort of already know each other, they're already going on adventures together, Geralt, for some reason, tolerates him. There really isn't a lot of point. There's an interesting point in that Dandelion is convinced devils don't exist. These villagers are making it up, you know, like, it's fast, and it's, I guess the point is that, like, not everything that's dreamed of in this world is real. There are superstitions, you know, there's stuff going on that even though there are magical creatures, people come up with irrational explanations for what those creatures are all the time. I guess that makes sense, but the fact of the matter is that Geralt has a little fight with a goatman, gets his butt kicked, and then spends most of the story tied up, waiting to be killed, before he's saved by, you know, an actual Deus Ex Machina, or Deus Ex plant.
And you hit on that second point, which I'd bring in. You know, this story does do our proper introduction to, and I would say the proper introduction to the character of Dandelion. Now, going back to what you said about the narrative, you're right, it seems a bit disappointing. Could we get this sort of loose fight, which Geralt loses, and compared to what else he goes through, I had that a bit iffy. And then the majority of the story, Geralt is tied up. And for my position, Geralt is just tied up and getting Geralt is tied up and just getting lore dumped on him. And thus, that's the experience of the reading. You're like, okay, I see you think this is important, and this is a cool dynamic to add to your world, but you've basically just dumped this on this story. Like, this story doesn't have enough of its own to kind of justify it. And I really like how you say that in the TV show. I'm talking about it a lot. Maybe that's slightly unfair, but I think it does impact a lot of people who are coming to these books. This relationship with Geralt and Dandelion, I want to love more in this first story, but I just can't quite. Something about the fact that, you know, this isn't the first meeting, I feel like I'm missing out. You do wonder, why are you friends? What is it that brings you together?
Yeah, I didn't feel anything like the sort of connection which the characters had in the TV show. And I think that's just because Geralt's relationship to Dandelion is a little bit the same. I'm slightly irritated by your presence, but I do care about you and want to look after you. Thing which a TV show has going on, but the TV show really amps up the idea that Geralt is just frustrated by Dandelion or finds him annoying. Sometimes that to a little too much. Like, it's like, okay, yeah, we get
the
dynamic.
The thing that this is missing out, though, I feel like it's heresy to say that the book is missing something that the adaptation had. Sorry, But an element that's really emphasised in the adaptation, which is very light in the book, or at least in this first story, is Dandelion as a bit of a PR man for Geralt. What does Geralt get out of his relationship with Dandelion? In the TV show, they're like, Dandelion is there to sing his praises and basically make people like him. Because we see it in the Witcher story and quite a bit in The Lesser Evil. The common people, they can't stand him. He is not welcome in the pub.
No. He's called the Butcher of Blaviken.
Oh, yes.
That's right. So, like, Dandelion has a utility in the TV show. Like, he has a job. Like, something we can recognize as value. The first episode he shows up, it's this one, and he coins a song. Toss a coin to your Witcher. An absolute earworm. And then in the next episode, he's singing it again, and the pub is singing along with him. And you're like, okay, yeah, I can see why. Even though Geralt doesn't like the song, he sees value in him. But more to the point, in the TV show, and maybe this is more present in later books and I just haven't seen it yet, Geralt's basically acting like a tsundere, you know? He's like, I don't like you, but really I do like you, you know?
Yes, I do know. That's kind of what we're just not getting here, and I don't want to be disappointed by it, but it does just bring this story, to be quite honest, to one of the lowest rankings in this collection.
Just a bit dull. The next story, though.
The next story is not a little bit dull.
This is a big one.
I like the next story quite a bit.
I agree. I think this one, if you didn't land this one, there probably wouldn't be a lot of future for the Witcher story. Because this is when it introduces Yennefer as an actual character. She's mentioned several times in the framing device. And it's pretty obvious from the framing device, if not from the story itself, that this is what the entire series is going to be about. It's about Geralt and Yennefer.
Those are some strong words, Geordie. Do I 100% agree? Mostly. 50% there.
You've read more of the books than I have. This is my impression.
I think this is definitely a split between Geralt's relationship with Yennefer and Geralt's relationship with Ciri on a big scale.
Fair enough.
But The Last Witch, we get our introduction of Yennefer properly. And I love the fact that we see her throughout the framing narrative and it's sort of built up this character. Who is this woman? Why does Geralt care about her? Such a cool first interaction. I'm just going to explain this for the story. So this story, we get a djinn. We get a genie. Three wishes. What happens is, at the very start, Geralt makes a bit of an accident. He makes a wish that ends up harming Dandelion. And he's like, oh my gosh, we see a lot of care for him in this moment. I think this actually does a lot more to build their relationship than the last story does. He was like, I need to help my friend. I've got to go and take you to this nearby town. And, Geordi, I don't even know where to begin explaining this. Like, there are orgies and magic and weirdness. How does it all play? How do we get from A to B? Because I understand them. Like, well, I know at the end, he's there with Yennefer in the ruins going at it, but I'm not quite sure how we quite...
So it is actually a little confusing because this is a really jam-packed story. A lot happens. When you compare it to the previous one, they're similar lengths, but this one is sort of like, it's not even action-packed. It's just we move from beat to beat really quickly. You know, Geralt takes a dying Dandelion who's been mortally wounded by his djinn to a town. Before he's let in, he's not permitted to go in because strangers are not welcome. It introduces the fact that there's this political dissent. He meets another elf. This one's a nice guy. And they say, like, oh yeah, there's all this trouble the town has with sorcerers. And the all because this one sorceress on the edge of town has caused all this trouble for the local politicians. So Geralt says, okay, well, maybe this lady can help me. He goes over there. He asks for help, and we're introduced to Yennefer not through direct meeting. He takes a slow step-by-step process through the house, and Yennefer kind of seems like a hot mess. You know, like, the place is filthy, there's a weirdly addled, maybe enchanted man looking for apple juice. She's like, wakes up completely hungover and disheveled. So it immediately undermines our expectation of what we expected Yennefer to be, you know, this grand enchantress, perhaps, you know, like this sort of figure out of Arthurian myth, and it makes her into sort of like
beautiful description,
down on her luck rock star. Speaking of beautiful descriptions, Sapkowski really wants to tell you about how hot Yennefer is.
I would say he does a pretty good job.
I would say yes, he does a good job. I think it's not his most she boobleed at him, you know? That would be the lesser evil, which is just outrageous. Like, Geralt, like, accidentally, like, a woman is about to duel Geralt and then strips her clothes off to fight him naked and that. It's, that's just ridiculous. This one, it's obvious that, like, Yennefer is flirting with Geralt. You know, she finds him physically attractive, so she's pushing his buttons. You know, she's doing things like, oh, you're gonna have to tie up my corset for me, please. So, you know, it's different in that she's literally flirting with him, and so the framing is different, it's less ugly, but yes, it's still very typical, like, you know, staring at her curves and, like, commenting on her breasts. You know, she bathes in the same room as him, but, like, does an invisibility spell, but he's looking at her curves for all the suds falling off her. It's not the most embarrassing stuff I've ever seen in this same oeuvre, but it's like, come on, this is a bit silly, isn't it?
It's definitely playing to a certain audience of teenage boys. So, and that's very clear. But for something playing to that audience, this is borderline tasteful. I think for me, at least, a matter of fact of that is what you said. You know, Yennefer's, the character, is playing into it to make our protagonist feel a little bit uncomfortable or slightly off kilter. I think that's where it kind of comes
from. That slight femme fatale, you know, beauty and sex of a weapon thing. But I think what does change it somewhat is there's parts of this I like and there's parts of this I don't like. So the part that I don't like is that the impression we get from Geralt is that he's not fooled by this. And the reason he's not fooled by this is that first thing he says is, well, she's not that attractive, you know, and basically he's basically calling her a butterface. You know, she's saying, like, she, you know, she's curvy and all that, but her face isn't that attractive. And he says this, like, at two different times. The other thing that happens is that, and this is just, like, flat out, plain old garden variety misogyny, which is that he says he's not attracted to her because he knows it's all fake. You know, she's a sorceress, and all sorceresses are ugly women deep down, because they're like the third daughter of minor lords who are trained in magic and then are magically augmented in order to be beautiful. And essentially, this gets back to a very real and existing stigma against women who get any kind of plastic surgery. So women who get boob jobs, women who get enhancements, people who get facial altering surgeries, and this is seen, latest is people who take, like, Ozempic, you know, people who lose weight using medication instead of running on a treadmill or dieting for an extreme measure or whatever. There's this sense in a lot of discourse around this that this is not genuine beauty, that this is somehow trickery, or that this is, like, cheating. It's taking the shortcut.
And it's very interesting in the context of the wider Witcher series, because Geralt really kind of goes hard on this in this first story. Doesn't bother him ever again, clearly.
It doesn't even bother him at the end of the story. Like, it's literally just this one bit. And I think it's just so, because the idea is, I think, Sapkowski is like, okay, I don't want to just throw the most beautiful woman in the world into Geralt's arms and have them fall in love. That feels too much like a typical male fantasy. So how about there's a rational reason for her to be super hot? Like, she's a sorceress. She can change her appearance. She can appear however she wants. Okay, well, that makes sense too. Now, I don't want it to just be that she's a complete uggo wearing an illusion over her skin. Instead, it's going to be one step beyond that. And the funny thing is, maybe this is adapted well better later on, because in the TV show, this isn't the first time we see Yennefer.
No.
In the TV show,
we get her story acting completely parallel in chronological order with Geralt's. So we actually learn the big twist at the end of his story, which, and by the way, this twist, it's ridiculous how Geralt figures it out, right?
What do you mean, Geordie? What do you mean, ridiculous?
I mean, it's a bit ridiculous that Geralt to roll a nat 20 on his insight score in this moment of crisis to figure out that that Yennefer's big insecurity comes from the fact that not only was she once like an uggo, she was a hunchback. Like, he literally hones in and figures out her exact disability she used to have, you know?
This almost feeds in a little bit, and I'm going to bring this point up again, because this actually relates back to what I feel about what you're saying earlier, about how Geralt talks about the magic being applied to Yennefer, as like her, you know, to transform and to make her beautiful. It just feels like a way of crowbarring either lore or backstory as Geralt's thoughts. I'm like, did you think that? Why did that pop into your head?
Yeah, because it's this huge assumption, which, I mean, I guess I don't know for sure. I know the TV show. I know that that's completely true in that case. Duncan, I assume that, yes, textually
it's
Yennefer
true.
Was once a poor hunchback.
I don't think...
Becomes, yeah.
I don't know if we get it confirmed much more than this. I do think there's a conversation further down the line, actually, where it does get relayed to us again. But, yeah, Geralt's bang on the money here. And the only reason I can think is the fact that the author wants to tell us this, so he just has Geralt know it.
Exactly. And that's such a huge jump. It feels a little silly.
And also, it didn't have to be
actually,
so specific.
I just remembered something else I want to bring up.
As well, I just think anything could have worked. Yep. Yes, what's your next point?
Yes, like the idea that she was once disfigured in some way. To say like, oh, it goes beyond just like, you weren't the prettiest sister of the bunch. You were in some way like... you know, disabled, like that was to the extent, and you feel like this internal shame about that, or that you'll never really convince yourself you're actually pretty. That we have a word for that. That's dysmorphia. The point is, actually, you know what? It's a crazy reading. It would be really interesting if you could interpret that as Geralt experiencing a form of dysmorphia because he underwent huge changes in his life, and then that's reflected in the way he recognizes that look in Yennefer's face, not to just say, ah, yes, that's the signature former hunchback look, but to be like, I recognize that same personal shame in my own body, that alienness. That's actually pretty good. I mean, obviously, there's a very deliberate line drawn between the alterations to Geralt and the alterations done to Yennefer to make them into what they are. I'm obviously not saying anything that isn't super obvious from, like, seeing the TV show. Again, that's my insight into Yennefer's backstory. But the idea that specific look could be something he recognises from himself, I like that idea, and it just popped into my head.
And it's also nice, because then that would give you that kind of why they have that kind of deeper connection quite quickly. They both recognise two people who have been changed significantly, to a certain extent, beyond their kind of will and their power to be what they are.
Absolutely. I wanted to bring up one more thing, which I just remembered. We're never going to read these books, so I don't mind spoiling it. Duncan, in the prequel series to the Shadowhunter books, there's a character the main character is a shapeshifter. Now, this is absolutely classic for any given YA fantasy adventure story. But guess what, Duncan? The main character doesn't think she's pretty, but the male love interest in the story fall all over her. The difference here is that she's a shapeshifter. She can appear literally as anyone she likes. There's a conflict in the story, an internal one, where she's like, I could make myself appear like anyone. I could change any facet of my appearance. And she doesn't. She never changes her appearance, like, permanently. She never makes a decision to say, I want to look like this. She never does any cosmetic change to herself. And I think that's because Cassandra Clare was really frightened of the idea of, like, actually having a character who could just choose to be whatever. And she was so afraid of the possibility of a character being able to radically alter the way she looked to be more in line with how she felt, with the idea that this could be some sort of representation of anorexia or anything like that, that she just ran away from it.
And it seems just absurd to me that any character would have the power to change any small aspect about himself. Remove a mole. You know, make their fingers just the correct length to make them more aesthetically pleasing. Just change their height on a day-to-day basis. The unwillingness to do that just shows a profound lack of, I don't know, I want to say courage, that feels a bit harsh, but just like not understanding that, yeah, it's fine for people to want to change the way they look. You know, people have the power to do that. It shouldn't be so shameful. And we reinforce the idea that it's shameful by telling stories like this.
A couple of things. Number one, this is actually not the conversation I genuinely thought we'd get hung up on when we did the Witcher series. Just going to put that out there. But to kind of build off that, and something that I find really interesting, is firstly, I very much agree from your viewpoint. Like, it does need to be kind of destigmatized. And I think one of my own personal feelings around it is kind of a good way to go about that. It's just remember that we all do it just on a smaller level. You know, if I sit there and I'm plucking, you know, if I'm plucking my eyebrow or shaving my beard, well, what am I doing? I'm changing my face to a way it's not, you know, naturally presenting itself, but I'm picking a preference, how I want to look.
Yeah, I got my girlfriend pointed out that I have my first grey hair and my moustache today.
Again, just going to say, how many years has it taken for that to happen?
Listen, I've got the occasional grey hair elsewhere. This is just the first one that is directly above my lip.
Okay, fair enough. I literally had my reverse grey hairs at 14 and my beard had grey in it by the time I was 19. Anyway, not bitter.
Duncan, you can grow a beard. I can't. You're winning here.
So yes, I think that's a really important point. And what am I going to say? I'm not disappointed necessarily that The Witcher wasn't quite swinging from the right place, but I also feel like it's something that didn't have to be added in there. And it's such a small moment in The Witcher series. It wasn't needed. It didn't add anything to me, but it certainly didn't make me kind of go off the whole rest of the books. But I would also say this is a concept that does get revisited quite a few times. There is a scene in a later book, Time of Contempt, where Geralt goes to a great gathering of sorcerers and mages, and this theme does kind of come up again, that, you know, no one's quite looking how they looked and everyone's representing themselves, and once again quite a negative light is thrown upon it. There is a little bit more analysis. There's one point where they do kind of talk about an older male sorcerer and how he chooses to basically present himself like your Gandalf archetype. And there's a bit of a nice conversation about, like, well, you know, because he wants to project power and wisdom, which is kind of interesting, but it still has the exact same issues where it falls down, particularly where it talks about the women characters that go through the same process. It's not treated on a level playing field even then.
What was I going to say? So to crack on with the story itself, I'd say the middle part is entertaining enough. You know, once Yennefer sort of... The actual, like, on-page relationship between Geralt and Yennefer is quite interesting because she's so extremely antagonistic towards him. And your whole way through, you're wondering, like, when is this connection, this love connection, going to take place? And I think a lot of people could read this story and not believe it, you know, could be like, I just don't understand why. But I think there is just enough actual charm and chemistry and connection between them. But I'm compelled by it, and I do like the ending.
I think what's quite nice about the relationship between Geralt and Yennefer, and again, I'm talking about kind of as it goes forward in the books, is that I can see why they have that initial attraction and their sort of playfulness. And one thing that kind of gets revisited later on, there's a short story in Sword of Destiny where Geralt, you know, talks about the times he's had with Yennefer. What's the fact that Yennefer has seen other people? They're both very long-lived characters. Both witches and sorcerers do not have normal lifespans. And, you know, they come together, they grow apart. It's a kind of like this evolving relationship. And that's really nice to see. I like it when it's not like, no, they're together always. I also quite like a bit, there's an amazing bit in Blood of Elves, where Geralt's writing Yennefer a letter, and he has this whole awkward kind of thought process, like, how do I sign this off? You know, my dearly beloved, you know, the one true, he's not sure. And he goes with dear friend. And Yennefer then basically passive aggressively just calls Geralt her dear friend throughout like the next half of the book.
That's very nice. That's cute. Yeah, and I think the fact that they have this Spitfire relationship, that it begins directly antagonistic, but Geralt sees, you know, something in her such that he doesn't merely want to save the town at the end. He's explicitly trying to save her, even as she tries to damn herself through her recklessness. And then they, of course, end the story after Geralt makes his final wish. And they end up, you know, the end of an action movie, the end of a James Bond movie style, having sex in the wreckage. I like it, you know, it's out there, but I've always been a sucker for, like, the hero and the antagonist have a romantic relationship. And it's just fun, you know, that's a fun little fantasy trope.
And I also think it's really quite nice that these two characters love each other very much, have their incompatibilities, and I like the fact that there's no element of trying to change each other. You know, they enjoy being with each other's company, even though they know that issues are just going to keep coming up. I really like that. So, Jordy, that's the last wish.
I'd say two more things about the story right before we end it. I like the twist that it's Geralt's wish, not Jaskier's. I had forgotten that twist from the TV show, so I was pleasantly surprised by it a second time. So that's how you know it's a good twist, when you're like, oh yeah, this is a good twist, I forgot. And I also like the fact we don't know what his final wish is. We know it's somehow incredibly romantic, that it connects him to Yennefer somehow. Did you say, Duncan, I didn't have it, so we never do?
We never do.
That's great. I'm so pleased by that. I feel like it would be spoiled if we did find out what it is. Because it has a profound effect on Yennefer. It feels like something that, obviously it changes their relationship, but it seems to change her as a person. So whatever it is, it's very special. And finally, in this story, there's a lengthy section where someone explains the different varieties of djinn and their different elements, and it's taken straight from the Dungeons and Dragons manual.
Oh, well, that is fantastic. Yes, and those dates probably line up to be in that order.
It's lazy. It's terrible.
I was just going to say, if we're talking about the djinn, I do like the fact that Geralt has he thinks it's a ward spell.
Yes, that is a good bit, actually. I had a good laugh about that. I do have a physical version of this book. I actually have the illustrated edition. Not worth your money. Beautiful cover. The art inside is just bad. But the layout of the pages is really good. So it's very paradoxical. I was listening to the audiobook version on Spotify whilst I was on a walk. They make the big reveal that, like, the secret spell that he's been trying to use throughout it is just someone saying, fuck off, Geralt. And I had a good laugh right in the middle of the street, being like,
oh, I'm glad we don't project any weirdness. But yeah, that's a nice joke. This is a pretty decent story and a nice one to end on. I think what we get in this first collection of short stories, we get an introduction to Geralt, and although we don't meet Ciri, a lot of the main characters are sort of put into their place. We've really got the core cast to care about.
Yes. Now, it's not quite true to say that this is the last one, because what we have neglected up to now is the Voice of Reason.
I'll be honest, Jordy. So the Voice of Reason is a framing narrative, and it's actually told in multiple parts. We cut back to it between each short story. Now, Jordy.
Yes. It takes place after The Witcher, explicitly. Like, it's the next thing that happens.
I shamefully have to admit something, and it's that I basically skipped over this. I was just like, I forgot this even existed when I read this book for the first time, gosh, over half a decade ago, and I was reading back, I was like, oh yeah, this does exist, and I literally flicking through, like, I don't think this is either A, good, B, interesting, or C, relevant to anything later on. I don't know if I was mistaken, but I was just flicking through those pages. Quick check with the eyes. Yep, cool. Moving on.
Yes, I mean, I understand. Like, this is really just to introduce these extra characters to you. Even, like, the big point of it, the idea that Geralt has this grand destiny, which Iola has a vision of, It's so vague, the idea that, like, there's danger and doom in Geralt's future. Like, I could have told you that, man. I could have told you that right from the start. I didn't need prophetic visions to tell you that. It really, as you say, much like in the characters, just introduces to everyone. Like, Dandelion makes his first appearance in this part. So long after the Edge of the World, they've known each other for a long time, he's back, he's introduced here, and then just shows up in the Edge of the World. Which I don't think is as compelling. I think it's just... Also, he's just insufferable in that chapter. There's a chapter which is all dialogue. It's just a monologue from Geralt that explains a bunch of lore stuff. Maybe that's actually where he explains the Trial of the Grasses. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
But you're right. It's just kind of world building. And I don't know the answer to this question, but I'd be very interested to know when this bit was written. Because I said, these short stories were all published kind of separately before collected in this volume. And I would love to know, was this written for this volume? I imagine so. And
I imagine so too.
So it kind of assumes, I think, that one, you probably maybe are invested in The Witcher already, and it just feels like a way to squeeze a lot of lore in around these stories. And I just don't think it was strictly necessary. And also, I don't think it even does that good a job feeding into each story. It's not like in The Voice of Reason, someone goes, well, Geralt, don't you remember that time when you fought those elves?
Yeah, totally true, totally true. Because and I think, like we said before, it's to its detriment. Because if you explain what a Trial of the Grasses are and then immediately have a story where he's going to get a kid to do those trials as well, Geralt looks like a dickhead, you know? We've just explained how dangerous these are, and then you want to invoke someone else? That feels like there's friction between those ideas.
Oh.
Actually, you know what? Maybe, this is what I didn't think of before. I accepted the idea that the idea of witches itself wasn't really concrete in Sapkowski's mind when he wrote Question of Price. Was that what it's called?
Yes.
But actually, maybe he hadn't even come up with the idea that becoming a witcher was in of itself super dangerous. Like, maybe that was, like, only come up with after, when he wrote The Voice of Reason as a framing story. Obviously, being a witcher is dangerous, but not necessarily becoming one, Warhammer 40k style.
It is very interesting. I do think, you know, these short stories do speak to a world that's kind of built as it's gone along, which is a bad thing.
We love that.
It's great, and, you know, stories grow in the telling, as Tolkien once said. I do feel this is quite a poor way to kind of reverse implement it, because also it doesn't give much context. One of the main reasons I would presume you're going to give this sort of thing is, I keep calling it a framing narrative, but it's not. It's just another short story that's mostly explanations and lore dump cut up around the other short stories. Can I actually propose something? Dodie, what do you think you would have felt like, though, if it very least could just given a little bit more, like, chronological context to each of the stories being told? Because I can only really assume that the stories as they're presented in this collection is chronological.
I mean, that's impossible. I mean, it's not true at all. Obviously, The Witcher is the one that takes place last.
How do we know that?
Because the events of The Witcher lead directly into A Voice of Reason. Like, the neck injury he gets in that is the one being treated in that. They mention him defeating Ystrigga. Characters who mention the events that happened in that, like, it's the same prince who's sending, like, hitmen after him, right?
Oh. Okay, well, now I feel the fool.
Yeah,
is it?
Could
this be to how little I skimmed over The Voice of Reason? I'm like, is he injured? Okay, moving on.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Okay. You didn't see a lot of utility in this. You've read it before. And you're right, those sections are not the most interesting. In fact, to be honest, part of the reason it took me so long to get through this is when I got to The Voice of Reason, I would slow down. I didn't feel pressure to move on to the next story because I'm like, okay, it's just going to be a next bit in between. Not that it's completely devoid of its function. It does tell you a lot more about the world and about Geralt's perspective, but it's not the most. They're not the most interesting chapters.
It makes me just put me in the mind of, obviously, I'm a big fan of a collection of short stories. You get them in both the Elric Tales and in some of the Conan collections. Sometimes the author, taking the Conan collections, not the original author, perhaps the authors that came later, they'll just throw in a paragraph, just be like, right, the characters travel from here to here, about this point in his life, and this is what immediately preludes this next narrative. Okay, go. And I mean,
I'm really surprised by it, Duncan.
Like one paragraph.
I'm really surprised by that. I thought you would really like the lack of chronology because it would remind you of Conan and such.
Well, the thing is, it's because The Witcher builds into that kind of larger narrative that I kind of just go, particularly around some of those relationships. Like, I love the fact that we know, you know, this is his first interaction with Yennefer. But things like around Dandelion and when he meets Struggleborn, I'm like, okay, how long has it been? And I know it probably doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter. But I'm just trying to put these in my own head on a timeline. I'm sure the fan base has many a timeline available online. But just from a reader's perspective, I'm trying to map this all out. And I'm like, can it be done? Does it matter? Dandelion's the one that always throws me, because Dandelion's a normal human.
Sure.
But he very much remains unchanged over a very large time span. There's a bit in the full novels where someone basically says to Dandelion that you must be approaching 40, you look 30, but you act like you're 20. Because essentially, for the timeline to work out and Dandelion to be in these early stories, he has to be like in his 40s by the time you get to like the main events for Ciri to grow up. And they're just like, yeah, just ignore it. Yep, he's just a really useful 40-year-old.
He's just a 40-year-old who never grew up.
He's the same guy.
Duncan, listen, he's a professional musician.
Well, that explains everything.
Duncan, you used the E word. We don't have to talk about it now.
Which one?
Elric.
What, the White Wolf?
Yeah, Elric, the White Wolf. Not to be confused with Geralt, the White Wolf. Or, to be fair, Jon Snow.
Yes, Elric. What a great bit of inspiration Elric provided. So, if The Witcher had no Morcock inspiration, like, if I'd never heard of it, I wouldn't believe it. That seems like a pointless claim. This is so much Elric is in here. Geralt, in many respects, is a little bit of a less poetic Elric.
Yeah, it's a less Elric poetic,
really likes, like, when Elric's...
They're both albinos, they're both mutants, they're both swordsmen, they're both sorcerers, they're both gruff and a little bit, like, on the edge of morality. Obviously, Elric skewing more towards evil. They both have, they're both tied up in grand destinies, even though they try to fight against them. They both bed lots of
beautiful
women.
Yeah, Geralt's your working man's Elric. Just through and through. They both have a psychic, a companion.
You're right, I'm totally on the same page as you. It's not, there's no point going through it all. It feels obvious to me that, like, it's absurd to imagine that there isn't an inspiration there. The author has claimed that there's no inspiration taken from Elric, and the author doth protest too much. I think it's unfair to say that it's a rip-off. I mean, he has a lot of commonalities in there, enough, especially the whole White Wolf thing, to make it, like, suspicious. But there's nothing wrong with it, per se. We both like Empire of the Vampire, and Gabriel, like, riffs on Geralt just as much as Geralt riffs on Elric. And, like, you know, you got the Black Lion in Gabriel.
I think what kind of really sets them apart, though, is the fact that Geralt is very much more kind of down-to-earth. And the general writing style as well, I just think is a lot more kind of grittied and bloodied in the Witcher stories compared to what we get in a traditional Elric story. There's not as much high-flying concept and abstractness.
That's true. I will say that the fights are a little too Matthew Stovery. There's a lot of flips and kicks and pirouettes. The word pirouette is used all the time. But it's also used, like, along with a lot of, like, actual, like, Hema language, which was surprising to me considering when this book was written.
And that's one of those, just to link this back around to our conversation at the very start of this, that is one of those ones, though, that I do get a little bit, my eye twitches and I think about the translation.
Yeah.
Not gonna necessarily put a mark against it. If you're certainly a fan of Elric and you're, you know, an interesting person who's coming from that direction, do I recommend The Witcher to you? Absolutely. Yeah. As a step in the journey of sort of more sword and sorcery fiction, The Witcher's great.
We should, like, get
it definitely
more...
transforms more.
Yeah. We should get more of The Witchers so that we can get more mainstream authors writing short story novellas. They collect all their stories together. Quick, punchy, pulpy stuff. I think that would be good for the fantasy genre.
I completely agree. I really enjoy The Witcher, particularly because I'm transitioning into the larger series. How it kind of turns from the short, kind of more pulpiness and tries to bring that out into a more late 90s Game of Thrones wider fantasy. But for where this starts, I think it just does a really good job. I love the fact that each story, you get a riff on a fairy tale. So you're kind of already, you know roughly what's going on, where things would traditionally go.
Yeah.
So that you can be delivered plot twists without too much additional work. I'm mainly thinking of, obviously, the story that rests on Beauty and the Beast, A Grain of Truth.
But there's also, you know, a reference
part that makes that plot twist work.
Like a king wants to hire Geralt to find a woman who only left behind a glass slipper at a party. And he's like, no, that's not my job. I'm a monster hunter. Go away. And it's just a fun joke.
There's a bit in Lesser Evil as well, where I think we get a reference to, like, staying with dwarves.
I don't remember that.
Is it Renfri? She talks about she ran away and stayed with, like, seven dwarves for a bit.
Yes, I mean, obviously there's a very obvious Snow White thing there with the hunter, though it's a much darker, edgier turn on that. I forgot about that up till now. But yes, there's a very much a Snow White and Seven Dwarves thing going on there. Duncan, overall, lots of stuff to recommend about this story. It has its things holding it back, like stuff involving women. It's not as flagrant as I expected it to be. Perhaps it is in the other books, because people talk about it a lot. I find it very funny that in the absolutely classic way in which when you have a successful TV show, the most successful and popular ships online are not the male main character and his female love interest, but his male best friend. So the biggest ship to come out of season one that I saw was Geralt and Jaskier, which is funny because reading the book, these are the two most heterosexual men possibly of all time.
I know, and in a horrible way, I was almost disappointed in that slightly. I wished that, and even going forward, you don't really see that kind of grow up in any other way. They are both very much as presented in this first book.
Ah, well.
Which, tiny letdown. And this is what kind of gets me with The Witcher, and I almost feel bad for the main author, because there's a major thing sort of in the cultural zeitgeist, like the video game, particularly The Witcher 3, blew The Witcher up. So many people came to it because of that. Not that they didn't have success before, but that was a real touchstone in the video game industry, and it got a lot more people talking about this series. And so when you're introduced to this series through multiple different adaptations, and you see so many other people give their spin on the characters, Triss Merigold being a key one, much more, how do I say, developed characterization, I feel, in the video games, almost compared to the books. She's barely there, side character almost, where she set up really as a second love interest in the video game. And you can get conflicted. I feel, particularly looking at just this first story, this is a very strong collection of short stories. There's some really good pulpy action and fiction and lore and the moral quandaries, particularly in Lesser Evil. Really, really nicely done. But I do appreciate that. Actually, I think a lot of people took this and ran with it. And the author developed it himself as well. I think it gets even stronger as it goes along. But maybe everything that came later is a little bit greater than this first story. So I can see someone picking up this first one and maybe being underwhelmed.
I wouldn't say I was underwhelmed. I'd say I was above-whelmed. You know, I liked it. I respected it. It let me down in some ways because it basically had a second draft in the adaptation. But I'm definitely interested in going to the next book. I like this a lot. I want to see what comes next. I might even give Blood of Elves a go at some point. We'll have to see. But Duncan, we won't be doing it next time.
No, we will not, Geordie. You're absolutely right. So, everyone, please come back and join us in a fortnight's time for our second book of the year. And this is a very special book. This is my pick. Is it my pick?
It is.
Yeah, it's my pick. Oh, it's my pick this time. Geordie, I want to pick a book that I've actually been meaning to get you to read,
Duncan, will it be next
for
time?
Quite some time. This was on a very early list of books to cover.
I'm stretching my mind back, trying to remember our original Google document, because we've done a lot of the books which we were supposed to read already. I can think of two which it might be. There's one that's like As Below, and the other one was Swords and Deviltry. Those are the ones I remember from our original list.
So you're very close, because it's by the same author as Below, one Daniel Polansky, and The Straight Razor Cure, the first in his Lowtown trilogy. I do believe this book has been released under the title Lowtown, just for, I believe, our American audience. So if you get confused, that's the one we're talking about. And
interesting. Okay, I have heard of the Lowtown trilogy. I have no idea what it's about. It sounds very dark and gritty. That's all I get from the fact that it's called Lowtown and Straight Razor Cure.
It's something which, and I'm just going to drop this in for long-time fans, I was going to do this sooner, but after your reaction to The Gutter's Prayer, I pushed this book back.
I knew you were about to say that the moment you said, I was going to do this sooner, but I was like, you son of a gun, I can't do this again!
I assure you, this I believe to be a much finer work than The Gutter's Prayer. Similar neck of the woods, though.
Okay, fine, we'll do it. But I can only spend so much time in fancy Detroit, okay?
Well, please, everyone, join us next time to discuss a dark fantasy noir detective story, The Straight Razor's Cure by Daniel Polansky.
Okay, well, now I'm interested. I like a noir detective story. Okay, then. Well, I'll be looking forward to that. And until then, I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
I've been your other host, Duncan Nickel. Till next time.
We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.